I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As the Arab Spring turns to summer, we know how most Americans viewed the uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia. Americans overwhelmingly approved and respected those who stood up and demanded freedom. But how do Egyptians see those pivotal days and their lives now? A new Gallup report just out today tells us. We'll talk about it in a few minutes. But first, back to this country, and we want to talk about personal finance. Now, the chances are good that within the last week you used a credit card to pay for something, maybe multiple credit cards to pay for multiple items in multiple stores. The U.S. Census Bureau actually has statistics on this. It expects that there will be 188 million active credit card holders this year. We thought we'd take a look at some important news in the world of credit and credit cards that could have a direct impact on your wallet. Here to take a swipe at these latest developments is our money coach, Alvin Hall. Alvin, always good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, and I'm ready to take the swipe.
Okay. Now, let's start with what I think many people might see as a sign of the times. These numbers that show that many people, when faced with the dilemma of scarce resources, are more willing to pay off their credit cards than to pay their mortgage bill. These come from numbers from a credit reporting agency called TransUnion. It says that actually that number has grown exponentially, and in the last reporting period, it was actually a majority of the people who'd fallen behind. Now, why would someone do this? And is this a smart strategy if you have limited dollars?
It's a calculated strategy. Imagine that you bought a house that you paid $250,000 for, and it's now underwater worth $140,000. You are saying to yourself, well, I'm never going to be able to pay off this mortgage, and I don't want to pay off a mortgage when the house is worth less. But I still have to be able to put food on the table, pay for the phone, pay for gasoline, be able to get to work. So people see credit cards as their safety net. Many of them have exhausted all the money in savings. They've tapped into their 401k programs. So this is the only thing they have keeping them, you know, sustaining them in their life. So, yes, there's a logic to it, but there's a very calculated risk involved.
Then tell us about the risk. What's the downside of this approach?
People forget that the major way people build wealth is through home ownership. So if you lose your home, you fall off the property ladder and fall off the wealth-building path that is normal in America. The second thing is, how long will that foreclosure or loss of the house stay on your credit rating? And I think people look at past experiences of other people, and they'll say, it might stay on my credit report maybe about 2 to 3 years. That's okay, because I can rebuild after that.
But if you're talking about people using their credit cards and staying current on their credit cards to just pay for what a business would call operating expenses,
yes,
the day-to-day money that you need to keep yourself afloat, you know, are they wrong? Especially when they see themselves throwing what the folk wisdom would say, good money after bad. You're paying for an investment that is of a fraction of the value that it formerly was. Are they really wrong?
They are really wrong, but they are also in a very difficult situation. And I think it's hard for people to imagine what it's like to be poor or have your back up against the wall. And what's more important to you is the shelter over your head or putting food on your table. It's a real horrible position to be in, but I think they are wrong to do it, because what it does, if your house is underwater, then you can understand. They say, I'm never going to be able to afford a house. But if the house is not underwater, then people should focus on making the mortgage payments,
and
or at least seek a modification.
At least seek a modification. Okay, the
yes.
Next topic is actually about credit. You talked about, you know, people have no idea what it's like to really be up against it. This is the opposite end of the,
yes,
the story. The New York Times reported that the three major credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, maintain so-called VIP lists of politicians, celebrities, judges, and other people deemed to be influential. You might not even know you're on such a list, but here's the trick of it, is that it reports that one of the perks of being on these lists is that if there's an error on your credit report, somebody actually deals with it, as opposed to the rest of the great unwashed, us, who,
yes,
apparently it's like you get shoved off into some file in the sky, and you know, and so what can you do about this? I mean, I think
I think
it's pretty of a shock to many people to feel that there is this sort of completely two-tiered system to dealing with errors.
Are you really shocked?
Well,
I wasn't. I really wasn't. Because we live in a culture today that really elevate celebrities and famous people, and they get extra treatment when they go through airports. They have special lines that they go through. They don't have to do the same things that you and I have to do. So I'm not at all surprised.
Okay, but so the issue is not that maybe they get red carpet treatment. The issue is what everybody else gets. And apparently what everybody else gets is this completely shoddy system where you don't really get a person dealing with your situation. So what do you do if, in fact, there's an error? And as you've told us many times, these credit reporting scores or these credit scores can be absolutely crucial to
absolutely
getting credit, getting a mortgage, things of that sort. So what do you do if you are not a VIP and there are these errors? What are you supposed to do?
Make the initial phone calls that you have to make and then follow up with a letter. Writing is still a really important way to get their attention, especially if you CC that letter to the Better Business Bureau or the state authority dealing with companies who are not following through. There are consumer laws that protect us against this. And the report, I think, also talked about the fact that people felt that the service they got from a lot of these companies was really shoddy. They would just do perfunctory checks of your credit record and then do light reports. And if something was wrong, it would be kicked back very quickly because all they do is give it a score of 1, 2, or 3, depending upon the problem. Go in writing as soon as possible. People forget that making a phone call today does not always get you the results that you want.
Well, the other issue here is there doesn't seem to be any incentive for them to fix these errors.
None, because they work for the businesses that ask for the reports. They don't work for us, the consumers. The law is really skewed. This is why I'm hoping that when it goes over to the new federal agency dealing with credit, that they will put some stronger laws to say if the report and the information you have is incorrect, it should be done in a timely basis. And they should put a real limit on this because this hurts people, especially people who are poor, who have been unemployed, who've gone through a difficult time. The credit report can affect their future employment. This is completely unfair and creates a completely two-tiered system in America.
Has this ever happened to you?
Yes. this has happened, and it makes me crazy. What makes me even more crazy, though, is that my grandmother, who never lived with me, who died 12 years ago, still gets solicitations to my apartment in New York City.
That's crazy.
Somehow, and on my credit report, her name appears. She has never lived with me.
That's
not
terrible.
Once. It is.
Well, I know you'll deal with it.
Yes, in writing.
That's right, in writing. Tell Me More's regular financial contributor, Alvin Hall, joined us from our NPR studios in New York. Alvin, thanks so much for joining us.
On with the war against this improper credit.
All right.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. The Astral is the name of a new novel from Kate Christensen. It's also the name of an aging Brooklyn apartment building that the book's troubled hero has long called home. That is, until the novel begins and his world is turned upside down. Alan Chus has our review.
Love and aging are the operative words in this book. The main character, once well-known poet Harry Quirk, has reached his late 50s at the end of his marriage and the end of his rope for what seems to him no good reason. Or really no reason at all. Luz, his wife of many years, believing he's cheated on her, has thrown him out of their apartment in the Astral, and we range around the Brooklyn neighborhood with Harry as he drinks, rolls along on his bike looking for a new place to live, and writes a long narrative poem with the title, you guessed it, The Astral. And as the novel shifts into a higher gear, he tries to keep the peace with his lesbian daughter. She lives as a freegan, which is to say, someone who forages for food and such from local dumpsters. And along with her, Harry tries to save his son from the clutches of a Long Island Christian cult. Harry, as Christensen portrays him in her closely laid-on prose, is moody, introspective, with a heady intelligence in motion that colors every sentence in the book. He's seeking in life the same sort of transcendence he finds in poetry. Good luck, Harry. But how fortunate you are to have a writer as gifted as Kate Christensen, who knows her men as well as some male writers believe they know their women, dramatizing your Brooklyn ups and downs. Her novel is definitely an up.
Kate Christensen's new novel is called The Astral. Our reviewer, Alan Chus, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Today, the video game industry converges on Los Angeles for E3. That's the Electronic Entertainment Expo. New games, new technology, and new devices are being unveiled in hopes of reversing a 5% drop last year in video game spending. One of the biggest announcements so far came from Nintendo. The company, known for industry game changers, revealed its latest video game console today. It's called Wii U. That's W-I-I space U. And for more, we're joined by NPR's Nina Gregory, who was at E3 earlier today. And Nina, let's start with the Wii U. How does it work?
Well, the Wii U is a game console, and it also has a controller, a wireless controller. It's a little smaller than a tablet, but it does have some tablet-like features, like a touch screen. On the side of the controller, it has controls that are familiar to Nintendo fans, buttons and a joystick. It also has a microphone, speakers, and a camera on it. The idea is that this will satisfy both serious gamers, a group Nintendo has moved away from, at least with the Wii, which sought to satisfy casual gamers, but it's easy to use with the familiarity of things that you know from touch screens on phones. The idea is that you can use two screens now. You have the one in your hand and the TV, but if somebody in your family wants to come in and watch TV, you can sort of throw or wipe the game so that it hits your controller and just sit down and play it on the controller. So you can sort of toggle between screens. You can also set it down on a table and use it like a board game.
Okay, so that's the Wii U from Nintendo. Sony's got in on the action too with the new handheld, the PlayStation Vita. What is that like?
Well, it looks good. The Sony press conference started with an apology from the company, which is significant. They've suffered some pretty serious network hacks. This has been an ongoing problem at the company, so it's important to acknowledge. At the same time, they did have big products to announce, and they were really well received. I played the Vita. It, too, has some touchscreen functionality to it, as well as controllers and buttons and a gyroscope and cameras. You can tilt the machine. You can point it. You can move it in space. I figured out how to use it pretty quickly, and I'm not the most sophisticated gamer. Okay. But this is geared at serious gamers, and it seemed last night like they were really pleased with it, especially with the price. Sony hasn't always been the most price-sensitive company, so its $249 base model was welcomed by those in attendance.
Okay, so Sony and Nintendo. What about Microsoft?
Well, Microsoft had some big announcements for serious gamers, which included the premiere of the trailer for the game Halo 4. That's their blockbuster intergalactic first-person shooter game. For casual gamers, though, there was also some really cool stuff, especially for the toddler set. There's something called Disneyland Adventure, which takes you on rides and through the park. And there's also Sesame Street Once Upon a Monster, where parents and kids can together be Sesame Street monsters. The parent can be, say, Cookie Monster. The kid can be Elmo. As you jump up and down and wave your arms, Elmo and Cookie jump up and down and wave their arms. And there's also Star Wars, where you can literally, you know, use the Force.
What does that mean, Nina?
Well, you are waving your hands in space. Zoom, zoom. You know, you can wave your lightsaber around. You kind of look silly doing it, but it's really fun to finally get to, you know, use the Force.
Okay, NPR's Nina Gregory, who's been waving her saber at the Electronic Entertainment Expo in Los Angeles. Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All Things Considered continues in a moment. With each passing day, news of Congressman Anthony Weiner's Twitter problem riveted the media. As NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik points out, Weiner's apology yesterday was nearly trumped by the appearance of the conservative blog entrepreneur who made the scandal a national fixation.
Forget Congressman Weiner for a moment, if you can just get those images out of your mind, and think instead about the performance of the other famous guy at the center of this scandal.
I want to hear the truth from Congressman Weiner. Quite frankly, I'd like an apology for him being complicit in a blame-the-messenger strategy.
Anthony Weiner brought this scandal upon himself, but the media's coverage of this story from the moments after he sent that errant tweet has been orchestrated almost entirely by one person, Andrew Breitbart. Breitbart has targeted liberal politicians and institutions, and he's a bombastic critic of the mainstream media. But in this case, he set the tempo for the press. The pictures shooting around the world were first posted on his sites. Even the network TV interview with one of Weiner's tweethearts was brokered by Breitbart, and Weiner singled him out for attack during a defensive interview last week on CNN. Yesterday, before Wiener's tearful confession, Breitbart stole the spotlight, once again hopping up behind the lawmaker's lectern at a Midtown Manhattan hotel, where he proceeded to lecture both Wiener and the press corps.
The media says Breitbart lies, Breitbart lies, Breitbart lies, Breitbart lies. Give me one example of a provable lie. One.
Breitbart was happy to embarrass a fierce liberal fighter and got a lead to Megan Broussard, a single mother from Texas who said she had swapped racy photos with Wiener. The thing about Breitbart is that he veers back and forth between sounding like an opinion journalist and a conservative activist. When Breitbart describes how his sites made use of Broussard's pictures, he sounds like a journalist.
Evenly pace it, let people savor the first photo and then, you know, tell them that there's going to be another one and, you know, get people into that refreshing mindset.
But when Breitbart tells me why he was doing it, he sounds like an activist.
I thought that this would put a sufficient amount of pressure on the congressman with a, you know, an escalating level of impact to each photograph. And the third photograph where he was shirtless, I thought that that would be a sufficient siren in his mind to realize that if he continues to go down this path, his peril is going to only get greater.
Upon arriving in New York City yesterday afternoon and learning Wiener had scheduled a press conference, Breitbart acted like a journalist, hoofing it to the hotel to report. Upon getting there, though, he took command of that lectern, answering questions from reporters and warning Wiener there were worse pictures to come. Among Breitbart's targets yesterday was Joan Walsh of the liberal Salon magazine. She has criticized his site's Big Government and Big Journalism for promoting highly disputed stories, such as the Shirley Sherrod video, in which the version Breitbart posted of a black federal official speaking about her own racism toward a white farmer was cut off before the redemptive end to her story. Salon's Walsh says he was right about Wiener, but that hasn't altered her skepticism toward Breitbart.
In a moment when, I guess if he wants to be a journalist, he is being validated and he did something right, all he's calling attention to is the controversy around what he did right. And in the process, he's flinging accusations at me that aren't true.
Some other journalists are more willing to follow his lead. Breitbart's criticism aside, he wanted the credibility of the mainstream media, so he advised Megan Broussard to share her photos with ABC and told ABC News producer Chris Vlasto how to reach her. Chris Cuomo was the correspondent on the story, which the network raced to report.
Well, as a journalism exercise, this was a very fascinating endeavor because it checks all the boxes for difficulty in journalism. Subject matter, difficult. There's a taste issue. There's a morality issue. There is an impact issue.
ABC says it paid Broussard between $10,000 and $15,000 for the rights to her pictures. Breitbart said he paid her nothing. I asked Breitbart again what he was, journalist or activist. Breitbart said, depends on the day. He doesn't like the term activist. He prefers provocateur. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR.